Jake, thanks for coming on today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem, man.
Before we get into things, and I'm super excited about this this episode, why don't you just give some of the listeners that maybe haven't heard of you or haven't followed one or two of your programs just a rundown on who you are and kind of your journey?
Yeah, Jake Tura. I've been a strength coach, or I've been training about a decade, a little bit over, strength coach a little bit less, but got into it because I was such a poor athlete in high school. And then, like, lifting turned that around. And over college, I gained a lot of strength, gained a lot of muscle. I actually suffered with jumper's knee for about 3 years. And lifting isometrics were something that provided a huge benefit to that. And actually, the more I learned, the more I look at kids with jumper's knee. And it's like, if you just do the most basic lifting or isometric exercises, you're probably going to see relief from that. So I've kind of got into the strength world just because of like poor education, poor knowledge to actually try to change your physiology or improve performance or decrease injury. And yeah, over this whole time, like, I got my undergrad, I got my master's, intern at University of Minnesota for a summer. Then I worked for a year at a Division II, and now I'm currently at Youngstown State. This is my third year now, or it'll be my third. Yeah. So I work with about, I think, 6 or 7 teams there. And yeah, my website, the stuff I release online, is basically for hypertrophy, hypertrophy, strength gain, and performance gain. Performance is mainly dunking basketballs. But right now I'm working on a jumper's knee resource because I think the knowledge out there for dealing with jumper's knee is not very good. And maybe that's because we don't understand tendons very well. And researchers actually will admit that even to this day, that they don't know what's going on, which is kind of frustrating because it's like, they're all like, we don't really know. And it's like, can you guys, like, please put some pressure on one another to figure this thing out? But yeah, so I'm working on that resource, and I was planning on getting it done very soon, but that's not happening because the more I look into it, the more that I learn. And it's like, I want to make this thing actually, like, complete. So hopefully that'll be done very soon so that people can have, like, not a quick fix for jumper's knee, but, like, a lot of knowledge to actually go about and train jumper's knee. Because the thing is, when you have a tendon issue, you can't just give – like, Ebony Rio is one of the researchers. He's like, you can never give a recipe. You can't just give a template for here's how to deal with the tendonitis or a tendinopathy. Like, it depends on a case-by-case basis. So, yeah, we can get into that through this talk.
Perfect. Yeah, it sounds like there's quite a lot of moving parts that I think a lot of people potentially don't fully understand. But just to kind of kick it off today, so you can change direction on this however you want, if you feel like I've maybe missed a step out or something like that. But I'd like to dive into kind of what are isometrics to start with for some of the listeners that maybe even don't know. And then what are the differences between an overcoming isometric and a yielding isometric? And why is that important? Is it important? Like, what are the differences that we might see there?
Yeah, so I got into isometrics maybe, like, I was about 1 year, a little bit over 1 year ago, because I mean, I still had jumper's knee, and it's like a lot of the treatments for jumper's knee, like when I went through PT, was like, you do the slow eccentrics, maybe on like a decline squat board or something, and it's super light, it's not loaded. And for me, for some people can provide relief. For me, it did not provide relief at all. So the big thing that helped me was just heavy, super heavy lifting, like super heavy slow resistance training. That was mainly back squats and front squats. I didn't do much single leg stuff at the time. Back squat, front squat, put a lot of stress on the patellar tendon, and that's kind of what healed it. But I still would have pain when I was jumping. Like, I would go dunk basketballs, and I would go for like a dunk session, and I couldn't jump very high at the time. This is a couple years ago. And I would just, my knee would hurt for about 2-3 days. So one of my buddies sent me a video, Keith Barr video, and I watched it. Pretty mind-blowing when I watched at the time, because he talked about isometrics doing short sessions. So his idea in the video was, whenever you do like a fast movement, your tendon acts like a sheet. The strong collagens get a stimulus, the weak collagens do not get a stimulus. So if all you do is the fast training, you never have the potential to heal the tendon. That's his idea. So when you hold an isometric contraction, it's a little bit different than the slow eccentric concentric, because when you hold the isometric contraction, like, you're static, the tendon, like, gets a chance to deform a little bit, like relax a little bit more, the strong collagen actually relax. And that was about, when you go about 30 seconds, he says this, it's called stress relaxation. The strong collagen actually relax, and they relax to like 60% at 30 seconds. And then if you go a little bit longer, it's not really worth it. So it's like, if you hold an isometric, say an isometric lunge for 30 seconds, you get a stimulus within your weak collagens. That's what he's saying. And as we go deeper, we'll see other people disagree with that. But so the isometric came about for me because of the knee pain. And they actually, when I started doing the isometric lunge and I hold that for 30 seconds, I'd hold it for a minute, a little bit longer sometimes too. It's like that provided so much relief for me. I don't know how long it took me, maybe a few weeks, maybe a month, but it's like then, and maybe there's some things you do that you probably shouldn't do. Like I would dunk every single day. And it's like, that's not the way to optimize your dunk performance, is to go and try to dunk every day. You can do it, but should you do it? Probably not. So I could dunk every single day, no knee pain. And whenever I did, I knew I need to, I just hit some iso lunge, I'd be fine the next day, you know? So it's like, it would give me a lot of knowledge, which gave me the power to treat my knee pain instead of just sitting there and being like, oh, my knee hurts, I can't do anything, you know? So then basically there are three ways, I think, of the isometrics. And one of them that I had used actually before, because Max Schmarzo had, with Matt Van Dyke, had that book about isometrics. Isometrics for performance, and from my understanding, they only really talked about overcoming, and that's what I put in. I have an ebook, Vertical Jump Protocol. We use overcoming isometrics a lot for like pre-training, because it can like potentiate your nervous system, and I guess strengthen you in a certain range. So like I would do pull against pins, split squat, pull against pins, trap bar deadlift, push against pins, like a calf raise. So like hitting some areas of the jump that you need to actually strengthen, and it actually wakes you up for training, which is awesome. So that's really how I use the overcoming isometrics. That's about it. Like I use it for like, you hold it maybe 5 seconds or some around there. And I think the idea is you get the nervous system like potentiation or just waking you up, and you increase strength in that certain range. That's, I mean, there's other people that use it for other reasons, but that's the only reason I use it for, is like wake myself up, strengthen myself in this range, and let's go train. and then it's like, yeah. And it's like, it's low risk, you know, like you don't really need equipment. I mean, that's why people are doing it over quarantine, 'cause you can like use a towel and hold it on your foot and do like a split squat or something. Yeah. It's cool. I use it here and there. And again, I use it in my vertical jump training program, but the one, I don't think that's going to help your knee pain. At least I just don't think it will. So you get the yielding. I mean, I'm not even, the phrases are like, yeah, the yielding one where you just hold a position is like you do a split squat isometric, just hold the position. It's basically resisting gravity. And Keith Barr talks about 30 seconds. Other tendon researchers talk about 45 seconds, because you need an actual, like, they say you need like a 70% one repetition max load on the tendon to improve mechanical strength of the tendon. And then by holding for that long, you're getting that stress relaxation as well, which can decrease pain, which can hopefully give a little stimulus to the tendon that is maybe not the healthy region. But so if people are doing, and that this is specifically for tendon, but it's like people will tag me in videos doing like a 2-minute iso lunge, like tendon health. And it's like, well, okay, yeah, but I mean, do you really, not really, because they say you need a 70% load. And it's like, are you getting a stimulus on your tendon if you're holding like a body weight load that's super easy and you're just holding it forever? It's like, no, like use some weight and hold for 30 to 45 seconds, and then you can say tendon health. Otherwise, yes, it's going to help your tendon, because it's probably gonna lengthen out your quadriceps muscles if your knee hurts, and that's probably what you need, like rectus femoris length. Maybe it's strengthening your hamstrings in that range as well. Maybe it's strengthening your calf. Maybe it's providing muscular endurance, muscular strength. Hopefully it's probably improving your kinetic chain as well, like the way that you run, because there's been quite a few testimonials of strength coaches talking about just doing the isometric lunge, doing it over and over, and then people improving running mechanics. So I think, yes, it'll help tendon health, but it's not specifically like what the research will say. It's more on other areas. So yeah, I use both isometrics, and right now, like people ask me how often I do isometrics. So I'm like, pretty, not really ever, actually. Like I lift and I go dunk basketballs because they worked for me, you know, like I had bad knee pain, but like they worked and it's done. Like I do them if I want for other reasons, but it's not like I need to do isometrics every single day. And I think that's the point I want people to get to, is like, don't use it as a band-aid. Don't be like, oh, my knee hurts just because I didn't do isometrics. Like there's something else going on. And if you can figure that out. And also like, I want to dunk basketballs and I want to lift heavy weights. I don't want to be doing isometrics every single day. It's not something I enjoy. I think Dr. Tommy John loves doing isometrics. Like that's his thing. But for me, I want to get on a basketball court. I don't want to have to do the isometrics. You know, I don't want to have to do the prehab stuff. So I think it gives enough for the distinctions between the two. I did say there was a third way. I think the third way is like, and this is more like the voodoo kind of like the max contract, where like you get in the position and you like pull the back hamstring towards you and you push the like you're trying to scissor your legs together.
Yeah.
And that's like a Jay Schrader thing. There's
more of like people extreme ISO.
Yeah, that's what I call it. ISO extreme ISO. And I've shied away from using the definition extreme ISO. You can see, I think I've never used the phrase extreme ISO because I don't understand it and I don't know what resource I'd need to look into to actually understand it. But yeah, that would be like a 30-second hold where you're just max contracting, or maybe 20 seconds. And some people say that's all you can get before you lose the sensation. And then they'd accumulate 5 minutes. And I'm like, man, that would just be boring. Like, how many sets you got to do to get up to 5 minutes doing that max contract? But yeah, that would be like a third way. That's a way that I don't really use that often. But maybe that would lie in between as like a potentiation, because maybe you could use that and you would get tendon health and you'd also get some of that like overcoming because you're actually maximally contracting. I don't know, but in my mind it might lay in the middle there.
Okay, and then so you actually mentioned the kind of, I think, is it tendon creep essentially, where you're starting to relax after 30 seconds? Is that what Barr talks about?
So like, and I'm not 100% on the terminology, tendon creep, stress relaxation. In my mind, I think they're pretty similar, where, as you hold the position, the it deforms more.
Yeah.
So like when you get in a split squat, you hold it, the tendon is a certain length. And as you hold it for 30 seconds, if you're under heavy load, like it's actually would be longer over time, you know, like it deforms. Like so
that,
the muscle
that
is
extra load, though, is going to be quite important, obviously. Like you mentioned 70% as a number there, but you think whether we just hold some dumbbells in our split squat position, like that's obviously a very important factor for tendon health.
Yeah, using an actual load to get the stimulus in there. And but if you're so out of shape and deconditioned, 30 seconds, 10 seconds might be tough. So then you're probably getting that. I mean, are you getting that? I don't know. So that's why researchers, they won't use a split squat isometric. I love the split squat isometric because it touches more on the movement, you know, like gait patterns. Like it touches more on you as an athlete and how you're going to move. A leg extension or a leg press or a Spanish squat, not so much. Those are the ones they use in research, is really like a single leg press hold at mid-range, leg extension hold at mid-range, and they use that load. And actually, I mean, I've had an athlete with ACL reconstruction, the basketball player, and he would do the isometric before practice, before games, on a leg extension, and he found the most benefit through that. So it's like, yeah, I say isometric lunge is awesome, but you got to experiment. And like, there's no recipe for one person. Find what exercise works well for you. I like the isometric lunge because I feel like, as much as I hate the phrase, you kill, what do they say? Like, you check a lot of boxes, right?
Yeah.
I'm not a fan of that phrase because these boxes are made up. But yeah, it checks a lot of boxes.
So you say, obviously, it's different for everyone. So where did I've seen you on like Instagram and things like that, and I've played around with it myself, actually, the straight leg, like isometric hold. Like, where did that come from?
That was in Tommy John's book. He had like a bunch of prerequisites he had for like, I don't know what he called it, but it was like basic human foundational stuff. Mm-hmm. And one of them was that stand. And then he had talked about it in a podcast with Joel Smith, like I think one of his early ones, where they were talking about like a movement that I don't know, anyone should be able to do. And Tommy was like, stand on one leg. And I was like the way he explained it was just really, was for me, it was like, man, this is awesome. So I went and tried it. And that was something I did every day. I did single leg stand every day, did iso lunge every day to hopefully get health back. So the idea is, when the foot's down, it connects the foot with the glute. And that connection could sometimes be like poor, because anytime you do a single leg exercise, you have to stabilize more, and you're getting more, like you're getting, like if you do a back squat, you could just, people who are powerlifters have and do back squats, they get a really strong back, but they might not have strong glutes or something, you know what I mean? Because there's so much stability when they do that, but as you go on one leg, I feel like the glute engages more, the adductors engage more, just by simply being on one leg. So it connects the foot with the glutes when you're doing, let's say, a gait, when you're gait or when you're running or something, you're always on one leg. So like that connection can get a little bit stronger. And then I used to do it just standing there, not really focused on that front leg. But if you actually bring the front leg up super high as possible, then it's getting the strength endurance of the front leg hip flexors, yeah. Which, I mean, I've seen over quarantine, actually, because I've done a lot of sitting because I've been doing a lot of stuff on my computer or talking with people, is like my left knee will sometimes get some like patellar tendinopathy in my left knee. I never had it there before. But then I do that single leg stand, and like my hip flexors would start cramping after a few seconds of doing single leg stand. So it's like, I would do that, and like, it'd be hard to do because it'd start cramping. But if you get in that split squat isometric and not really get in a position where you're just dumping the pelvis forward, because a lot of people get there, but actually like bring the pelvis a little bit under you, then you can get some length in that front hip flexor. So I think pairing the two, especially for patellar tendinopathy, is like you can get the length at the rectus femoris, but you also add strength. I mean, you're adding strength to both. But yeah, the point of the single leg stand is like the foot, the glutes. And then if you want to bring that leg up, then you're getting the hip flexor endurance. But from what I've, my experience and reaching out to like hundreds of random kids who want vertical jump tips, like you do the iso lunge and you do the single leg stand and you do it every day and your knees feel better and you jump higher.
What type of protocol are you given for kind of both of those exercises?
Like this is something, so I'm working on the resource.
Is that the secret that we can't give out?
Well, no, because I'm working on the resource and that's that part. I haven't got there yet because it's been so difficult to get the structure and function of tendon like 100% down. But what I've said to kids is just like accumulate 3 to 5 minutes. And then it's like, I don't care how you do it, just do it. But I feel like you can get more adaptation if you go to failure. But the problem is if you do the single leg stand and you go into failure, you can watch your foot on the ground. And that's just like, the met heads are all over the place. Like the first met head, fifth, you're all over. So it's like, do you really want to be trained like that? Or do you want to be more stable? So there's some guidelines on that, but it's like right now is like, just accumulate that time. If you just accumulate that time, there's no pressure for you to get better than some certain time at any given day, just do the work. And you'll see some positive benefits over time. But it's like, if you can't get a single leg stand for like, I don't know, 1 minute, you can't get a split iso lunge for 1 minute, I think you're in a pretty bad spot. you need to get better at that. And Tommy talks about the minimums of three minutes. And it's a lot easier to do when you have training partners. It's a lot more difficult if you're just there by yourself going through this pain, this misery. So when you have people around, it's a little bit different. But I'm going to give a little bit more guidelines on that. And then it's kind of just made up. And from what I've seen, if kids just accumulate the time, they get benefits from it.
Nice. So what is, if we look at kind of training the tendons or the isometrics from a health perspective, that's obviously going to be these longer duration, well, 30 seconds plus like we've just talked about. But what happens when we talk about, or a lot of people say, oh no, I just need to rest the tendon. Like, I think we're past the point now, hopefully, where we know like that rest is bad essentially. And we need to start some sort of loading into the tendon to try and get some more structural changes. Can you just talk us through kind of that protocol of maybe like slow for tendon health, if that makes sense? And am I right in thinking fast for performance? Can you talk us through that? And then what type of adaptations we're looking for?
Yes. So you want to maybe get some slides together. Maybe if I go over these slides, it'll be better. Because sure, I think if we talk about rest, like if you understand the structure and the function of tendons, you can kind of understand how they adapt to rest. And I have a little bit of section in there about rest, but that's the advice I got when I went in for jumpers. Was there like, you need to rest for 3 months because that's how long it takes for the collagen to turn over. And looking into it, I'm like, where did they get 3 months from? I have no clue. But like, I would literally rest for like 2 months. I would do nothing on my knee for 2 months because that's the advice doctors give me. And it did not help at all for my jumper's knee. And that is 2 months of wasted time. Like if you're taking 2 months or 3 months of resting, you're just wasting time and your tendon's going to get worse because you need to load your tendon. So if we can go over that, I don't know how to share my screen. How do I do that?
If you hit right at the bottom of your screen, that green button.
Oh, share screen.
There you go. I should do it, hopefully. There we go. I got you.
Perfect. You can see that?
Yep.
Good to go. Okay. So yeah, we were talking about rest, and really, I mean, if anyone's going to rest, it would usually be pain. Like most of you don't want to rest ever. You want to be training, you want to be playing your sport. So, here's the thing Jill Cook and some other researchers put up where they looked at pain, and then it's like, we can look at structure. So structure would be on the right side there, pathology. And then we can look at function, which it says their function, the blue box. So it's like, if you're in pain, let's say someone's in pain, is like, you would usually have a structural pathology, something messed up with your tendon, and then you usually have poor function. So like the two will go together. And there are some weird cases where those two are not together. We won't really talk about that because it doesn't really apply. But if you're in pain, if you have tendon pain, like let's just say jumper's knee, because that's what I've, or yeah, let's just say jumper's knee. Like they can do imaging and usually do MRI or ultrasound, and they'll see that you have areas of like disorganization like basically the collagen is made up of type, the tendon is made up of type one collagen. And if you have pain, it's probably going away from type one, going to type three. You're probably getting like more water in there. You're getting a lot of really messed up things that you can see on the imaging. So if you have pain, you can get imaging, it'll be all messed up. And then that'll go along with poor function because you're in pain. Like it just, it doesn't function to store and release energy. You can't really do the movements you want to do within your sport. So the pain that you experience is usually paired up with pathology and poor function. So if we look at the structure to like, we look at the pathology is talking about there's something wrong with the structure. If we just look at the structure of tendon, you have the tendon, it goes into fascicle fiber, fibrocollagen, and collagen is what that photo there. You can see it's all wavy. It's really well organized. The dark like purple spots are the cells. So like there's very few cells in the collagen. Tenocytes is what they're called. And something interesting, if you look at the fascicle, like there's a bunch of them there, is like when you're young, they actually can slide and rotate the fascicles. So it's not even about collagen. The fascicles can slide and rotate, and that helps you store and release energy, like deal with these huge loads that are happening at the tendon. And as you get older, they think that it's called the interfascicular matrix. They think that it gets worse at like rotating, twisting and everything. And they think that it's from like less elastin, like these things that you lose as you get older. So when you get older, is it necessarily that collagen, like something is happening bad at the collagen level, or is it that the intrafascicular matrix is just worse at its function and that's why your tendon doesn't function as well anymore? It's an interesting thing to think about. But if we're talking about jumper's knee, it's usually in young jumping males. So you don't need to worry about intrafascicular matrix. You probably need to look at the collagen if you're going to look at the structure. So yeah, you can see it's like a hierarchical order, and then you can see the collagens is all really well organized. And if you compare this to a ligament, this is way more organized than a ligament. And anyways, let's go into, yeah. So the structure on the left there is the collagen. The top one would be the healthy, and then the bottom is like messed up. You see all the cells, like it actually gets more cells. It gets like nerve ingrowth. A lot of messed up things happen when you have tendon pathology. So the photo there on the right is a healthy patellar tendon on the top left there, a healthy patellar tendon. And then it gets a little bit disorganized, and the bottom one is a ton of disorganization. So that's basically, like, you can see the color is type one collagen, and then the blue and the red would be like type two, type three. There's type four, there's type five, there's all this stuff, but you want it to be type one. Type one is good at transmitting load. It's what you want in your tendon. It's like, I don't know, 95, 99% type one. But when it gets pathological, it goes all bad. So then another superstructure, I mean, I left that photo in because I'll talk about that, but is they did this study where they looked at the C14 content. It was like the time they did atomic bomb testing, and the collagen was not turning over compared to skeletal muscle. Like the skeletal muscle was turning over pretty fast, but basically, and I can't really explain this 100% because I'm not really the best at reading this. I've understood it before, but now I've kind of like, but anyway, collagen doesn't turn over in the core of the, this was in the core of the Achilles tendon. The collagen is not turning over in these people for years. It's just staying like that. So if we look at the photo there, is like, if your collagen gets all messed up, it's like, are you going to even have the opportunity to have it turn over? You know, like if it's never turning over, why would we even focus on structure? And another thing, I'm gonna see what I had next. Yeah. So another thing with the structure is like Joe Cook, Sean Docking, he does a lot of imaging studies. He was saying, if you look at the area of green in all those tendons, there's a lot of green area. So you have a lot of healthy tendon that will respond to loading that you can use for function. So we don't even care about the bad part of the tendon. So they would say, their phrase was, treat the donut, not the hole. Don't worry about the bad section of tendon, worry about the good part. So the main idea here is, if you have tendon pain and you go in for imaging and you see this on your image, like, you probably shouldn't even get imaging in the first place. Don't even worry about it. Cause if you have pathology, it's probably going to look bad. There's going to be some disorganization. Just don't worry about it, because you have enough good tissue in your tendon that we need to get on a loading program. But if you see something like this on your tendon, you're going to be like, oh, I need to go lay down. I need to put my knee up. I need to rest. And that's the worst thing you can do. So don't worry about the structure. You should worry about getting that thing back to function. So the researchers are basically like, don't rest. So yeah. Yeah. But basically, so Yeah, so then if we look at the function, we kind of cover the structure there. So like the structure, collagen, you can see how it gets organized, how it gets messed up with pain. So when you're playing sport, any fast movement, the tendon's viscoelastic, so the tendon works like a sheet when you're moving fast. You're jumping, you're sprinting, kicking, you're throwing. Tendon works like a sheet. Everything works together. It needs to get very stiff, and that helps you transfer force. When you do something slow, like a Nordic, or controlled Nordic, or you do a slow, a heavy back squat, which will be slow because it's heavy, the tendon molecules can actually work more individually. So they can actually like break links between each other, cross links between each other, and that will theoretically be like a healthy thing for your tendon. Maybe is it healthy because of the specific adaptation of the tendon, or is it healthy because the muscle is getting stronger? Probably both. So these are how the tendon acts based on the speed of movement. And yeah, if we look at the, on the left there, that's basically the stiffness, like as you add, and that's just like all of the tendons within the human body are pretty similar. As you add more stress, as you add strain, you pull in the tendon, it reacts by like not pulling so much, so it actually will store energy, but they're all very stiff, and the stiffer you can make the structures, the harder it is to break. Maybe the more energy they'll store. So on the right there is looking at the function, like how the tendon acts on the muscle end of the tendon. That red line, it's actually pretty compliant, and then on the bone end, the green, it's actually pretty stiff. So like the tendon actually changes from stiff to compliant on different ends. It's probably compliant towards the muscle because the muscle contraction causes like shearing. It actually breaks down the tendon, breaks down cross links, and you need it to not be extremely stiff. If it is stiff, it risks, because if a muscle's pulling on a super stiff, if a muscle's basically pulling on bone, there's a high likelihood that the muscle is going to rupture. You're going to get a muscle tear because the muscle needs to pull on something that is not that stiff. Mm-hmm. And then if we look at function, so something interesting with different tendons, because we talk about them, we want them to be stiff, we want them to store energy, we want them to release on all these energy storing tendons. Something interesting Jill Cook had talked about was, if you look at like that's the Achilles tendon, the patellar tendon, these are tendons that I really care about. I think any athlete cares about. I mean, what other tendons we care about? Maybe if your upper body, something in your upper body, but it's mainly that, or if you have a hamstring pull, you care about that. But let's talk about the Achilles tendon. So she says you see how long it is, and she says it's very good at storing energy, storing and releasing energy. If you look at the patellar tendon, it's more of like a fat thing, and it's more fat, and it's more not as long like the Achilles tendon, and it's kind of like, I mean, it's just the way it's located, like within the bones and the way that everything bends, it's kind of different. So like she says that's good at being resilient to loads. So thinking of the function of different tendons is like you have the Achilles. We do all the pogo hops and everything to get the Achilles better at storing, releasing energy. We don't really do pogo hops for the patellar tendon. We don't have a pogo hop exercise for the patellar tendon because it's not how it acts. It's there to be resilient. So when you jump and you land, it needs to be resilient. When you cut, it needs to be resilient. But we look at the Achilles tendon as more of like a performance tendon. They obviously both matter for performance, but I feel like the Achilles tendon has a huge chance to improve your performance. And if your patellar tendon is just not resilient, it's all it's going to do is prevent your performance, because you're not going to be able to jump and you're not going to be able to cut, because it'll probably be in pain. So that's an interesting thing to look at, is like the different function of tendons. Hopefully that doesn't get everyone's sidetracked. but yeah, so we're talking about rest. Keith Barr, he looked at, I think this was 5 weeks of immobilization on someone, where you look at the stiffness of the tendon, and that was on the left there, that photo I had, where you look at it's more stretchy towards the muscle, it's stiffer towards the bone. If you rest, everything gets stiff, and probably because the muscle stopped contracting, the muscle stopped making the tendon more compliant towards the muscle end. And that's not good, because it risks rupture of a muscle as you go back into activity, because the muscle doesn't want to pull on something extremely stiff. So when you rest, let's say you're resting your patellar tendon. Actually, the patellar tendon is a little bit different. It's hard to talk about, because if you rest your patellar tendon and go back into sport, I don't think you're going to rupture your quad. You're not going to tear your quad. At least I just don't think it's going to happen. But if you take your calf, if you rest your Achilles tendon for 5 weeks and then you go out and run, there's a high likelihood that it's going to happen to your calf muscles. So yeah, resting, like these are basic, like fundamental properties of tendon function. And when you rest, it is not good. It all goes bad. And when I showed you that photo of the pathology, Jill Cook, Ebony Rio, Craig Purdom, all these tendon researchers, they're basically like, when you rest, it goes to pathological. Like it's not good for your tendon. If you look at your tendon and it's all messed up like that, and you rest for 5 weeks, it's going to look like that anyways. And if you look at your tendon, it's all messed up, and you train. If you look at your tendon, it's all messed up. It'd probably be like that for the rest of your life. You just got to have good tendon there. So it's like, all you have to do is you got to load the area. Just when you focus on rest, it's probably not the best thing to do. I will say this though, is if you have such extreme pain from a tendinopathy, like, and you can't load it because there's so much pain, you can't even do isometrics because there's so much pain, then do whatever you can to decrease pain. If you need to rest, rest. If you need to ice, do that. If you need to take NSAIDs, do that. Because there is inflammation that taking non-steroidal anti-inflammatories could actually be somewhat beneficial in that acute pain phase. Mm-hmm. Get massage on it. Get needling. Get whatever you need to do so that you feel better, so that you're capable of loading it. Because the sooner you can get to loading, the better. And when we talk about load, so like these are loads at what – Peter Malieris, I think that's how you say his name. He's a tendon researcher. He talks about high and fast loads. So these are high and fast loads on the tendon. And that's what's mainly provocative. So like if you have a tendinopathy, this is what's going to hurt. If you have patellar tendinopathy, patellar tendinopathy is very simple. This is going to hurt when you do these activities that are high and fast, high load and they're fast. Not going to feel good on your tendon. So that's something you can't do. So if it's like, my tendon hurts, I can't load it. Well, you can't load it in the high and fast activities. Don't do those activities. Maybe you got to take them completely out. But if you do something that's high and slow, like lifting heavy weights, isometrics fall in here too. They're with heavy load. It's a high load, but it's a slow load, and that is not provocative for a tendon. So that's something you could do to actually load the area and get mechanical strength in the area. If you're just playing your sport, it's not going to happen. So these are loads you could use if you have tendon pain. And here's like an example of what the tendon researchers do. That graph on the left, you have tendon injury, you do isometric work, then you do eccentric, concentric strength, and you basically get back into return to play. And then here are the examples of the tendon exercises, or the isometric exercises and the isotonic exercises they use. There's an argument of like, do we need to do isometrics? Can we do isotonics? And it's like, well, if you deal with like team sport athletes and they get a patellar tendinopathy in season, if isotonics are painful, then you're probably not going to use isotonics. And what we just talk about, you got to load the area. Isometrics are the thing that are probably not going to cause pain, are probably the least likely to cause pain are isometrics. And they decrease pain better than isotonics afterwards in Eben Rio's study. But her study was with 6 people, so a very small sample size. But yeah, if we talk about just team sport athletes, they have pain, basketball player, they have pain in season in their patellar tendon, and it'd probably be a male because it doesn't happen very often in females, is you could do isometric holds, and that will decrease pain. And also, you don't want to add in some form of exercise that's going to like blow them up and make them super painful. And if you're like, we got to do 70% max squats, and they haven't done that in a long time, they're probably not going to work so well. They're going to be sore for a week. But you can do a 70% isometric hold, and there's not really much muscle damage. And they would actually respond well, get a response to their tendon. So that's why I think they'd be could be so beneficial. And then when we talked about structure, like how structure, it cannot change at all, leave it alone. This photo was Keith Barr did basically a case study on a pro basketball player. On a photo A, you can see right under the patellar tendon, there's like a white spot. So like that could be the structural disruption, the same as that red area. It's hard to say because he didn't do the ultrasound. It's just an MRI. And then as it took a long time, 1 year later, it was getting better. And then 18 months later, it was basically gone. And it went along with the guy had no pain anymore. So it's like, maybe you could actually change structure. And that would be the Keith Barr idea of, because with this guy, all he did was the isometric holds on a leg press. He might've done another exercise. But it was the idea of the stress relaxation. You hold an isometric hold for 30 seconds with a heavy load, and the strong collagens relax, and then the weak ones get the stimulus. So his idea would be that white spot on the photo A, those are the ones that are getting the stimulus, and then over time they adapted to get better. Now, this is like one case study, and I don't think anyone else has replicated this, so that's why it's hard to say. But maybe you can actually change the structure. And if that makes you like an athlete, if you could placebo them into believing that, you know, that'd be awesome. Like, you probably should believe that you could change structure, because nobody wants to see a tendon and be like, oh, I messed it up. It's pathological. It's going to be stuck like that for life. If we could say, hey, maybe you could change the structure, that could actually provide relief, because now their brain is a little bit more like bought in. But I think this is the last one I had on the tendons is I gave this tendon presentation on Strength Coach Network. And I mean, I don't think anything in there was wrong, but I've had the chance to learn a lot more over the last 2 months, 3 months. And you can zoom in so much on the tendon, like look at the structure of the tendon. How do we get, how, what is the function and the structure of the tendon? And that's, yes, that's important stuff. But what is the reason why your patellar tendon on your right side got overloaded in the first place? It's definitely, yes, understand structure function, but there's something else going on that caused that. Something as simple as if you're a dunker, you play basketball and you're just jumping off the left leg all the time, you're a single leg jumper, and this is something like Ben Patrick, knees over toes guy, I had talked with him about, was like, if you just do the same exact pattern over and over and over, it's probably going to lead to some overuse injury, and maybe that will be in your tendon. So his idea is his dunk balance idea, where like you jump off the left leg, sometimes you jump off the right leg, you jump off both legs, you do a left right plant, a right left plant. Doing stuff like that is like, then you get, you can do, still do the same activity, but you're taking the stimulus off and you're giving some variability. So maybe the reason why a patellar tendon hurts is because you just lack movement variability. You're just doing the same exact thing over and over. You're a kid who's like 16 and the only sport you played is basketball, and you just drive to the right side over and over. Like you have no, maybe you run out of movement variability, you know? So something I had talked with some PRI guys and David Gray on the ribcage pelvis. So, like your knee could hurt because of your ribcage. If your ribcage is flared and your pelvis is dumped forward, and now your hamstring is at a lengthened position and it can't co-contract when you hit the ground or when you jump because it's at a lengthened position, that could be leading to knee pain. And then another thing, I mean, that's just one example. Joe Cook had talked about, you can do the isometrics, sure, and you can get the tendon feeling better. But if you hop like a duck at the beginning and you still hop like a duck, it doesn't help. You need to fix function. Like if you see someone running and they're entirely favoring one side and you do the isometric, let's say it's a leg extension or a leg press, like that doesn't help the function, you know? Like you're focusing so, you're zooming in so much on the tendon and getting adaptation around the tendon that it could be a global area. So being able to zoom out at the same time, looking at the structure and function of tendon, I think is important to actually get to the bottom of it. But like, I'll admit, I mean, I've spent so much time trying to understand tendons and why this can happen. Tendon researchers also are like, they still don't know. But you got to look at the tendon and then you got to look at everything else that could be influencing it. And it can be a long process, but yeah.
So I know like David Gray, I think, talked about as well. I think it might have even been on your podcast that I heard this. Is it to do with the TKE exercise? Working the TKE is a no-no because it teaches, is a terminal knee extension instead of like before hip extension. That's like, and then you're reinforcing these kind of incorrect movement patterns, and that could be.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's like you, I mean, and how many, you could talk about the TKE, we could even talk about the leg extension too, you know, like you're just training knee extension, or if it's a leg press, sure, there's some hip flexion extension, but maybe you're just training knee extension again. So it's like, you have that's an example too. You have an exercise that provides pain relief, but it does not address the entire function, the entire kinetic chain. And in the in the short term, it could provide relief, but in the long run, it could actually be bad because you're just training. Like all you're doing is training the quad. That's the only area you're training. You have this athlete, this entire body, and all you're focusing on is training the quad. In the long run, that's probably not the best thing to do. Yeah. How do I unshare my screen?
I think if you just hit the same button, you should be good.
Oh, stop share. There we go.
There you go. Yes, I mean, it's essentially just more of a band-aid than kind of finding the root of the problem, if you know what I mean.
Yes, and that's why, and another reason my weight room doesn't have a leg extension or a leg press, so I've had to find other, but that's why I think the isometric lunge, single leg stand is in a different boat altogether, because that's more on like trying to connect neurologically the foot and the glute, but it's like, the isometric lunge can actually somewhat address function because it's like an exaggerated gait pattern. And it's not, you know, and you're not in knee extension. You're not training knee extension. You're training the deepest position, the most exaggerated position of a walking pattern, which something David Gray said, which I think was awesome, was either you're getting better at gait or you're getting worse at gait. So if you're in the weight room and you're like crazy anterior tilt, squatting, bracing, you know, like that could be making you worse at gait. So it's like, how much of what you do can actually be causing more pain? It might be providing short-term pain relief. Sure, if you get on a back squat and you lift heavy 70% load and you're used to it, it can make your knee feel better. But in the long run, if it's just making your function worse and worse, could it actually be causing more harm than good? But That's the problem. Most people just want quick fixes, you know, they're not concerned with long-term. So they want to do the leg extension and the TKE. But yeah, TKE is something that I used to do. It didn't provide much pain relief for me. But yeah, that idea of just reinforcing knee extension. Whereas if you look at what David Gray talks about, if you look at even like a Darian Barr talking about squatted running and like keeping in a more knee extension or knee flex position, and you can even look at Achilles tears. I hate to talk about the mechanism of injury because it's very hard to change, and a lot of that's related to fatigue. But if you're someone who's always knee extended and you take a step backwards, like that's the mechanism of rupturing an Achilles. That's probably gonna happen in a older age athlete, but you could also say the same for pronation because a lot of those cases are in pronation. So then I could say we should avoid pronation, but I'm not going to say that. So that's why I kind of avoid the argument.
Yeah, fair enough. And can you, because you actually mentioned it, the lunge position that we're trying to get into is quite a long kind of stretch lunge position. Do you mind just talking? Are we, just for maybe the people that have never seen this lunge before or heard of it, is it a regular lunge? Is it kind of knee stacked above ankle, or is it a longer stretched out lunge with the heel off the ground? Like, how are you attacking this?
Yeah. So basically I think the way to start, and if you're like Jay Schrader, extreme ISO, you might have a problem with what I say, but whatever, just, this is the way I do it. And it provides, and it gives results. I think the front knee should be like right over the ankle. So like the shin is straight up and down. And then it basically is like 90 degrees with the thigh. If you're in that position, it's going to be pretty tough. If you're out of that and your thigh is higher or your knee is forward or back, like it's just way easier. And you can do it probably. And maybe I should talk about this too. If you have patellar tendon pain, sometimes if you get in like a deep squat position, like in a big knee flex position with load, it can actually be painful. So for someone with really bad patellar tendinopathy, if they want to hit the extreme ISO, maybe you go higher actually. Just make sure you're using load so it's a difficult position. But if you want to make it difficult to just body weight or just difficult in general, it's getting in that 90 degrees in the front. And then in the back, some people talk about like going as far as exaggerated as possible, like the back leg is way back. And when I think when you see that, you just see a dumping forward of the pelvis, so an anterior tilt to the pelvis. And if we talk about making gait better or worse, that could be making you worse. So I think if you get in more of like the knee is more forward, you actually squeeze the butt so they could get the pelvis underneath you, the rib cage pelvis are in a better relationship. That could be better. Now, these might be things to take into consideration if you want like 100% benefit out of the isometric lunge for your knee pain. So if you don't, and you just want to hit the lunge and get in a crazy dump forward enter tilt, I mean, I don't have a problem. Go ahead. It's still going to give a stimulus on the tendon. It's still going to like strengthen the muscles around the area. But yeah. And then on the front leg, if you come up off of the heel, you can get like a better contraction of the hamstring. I think it's also better because that's more of a position you want to be in sports or something. Maybe when you're jumping is more on the forefoot, but some people will do it and they'll go like crazy high on the toes. And I'm not a fan of that. I think if you actually get on the arch, like the transverse arch, which will be further back than being on the toes and not actually bringing the heel way up, I think that's a better position to be in. Cause I think if you're on the arches, like the arches of the feet, if you just bring up a photo of the arches, like it doesn't have anything to do with the toes. And I think people, when they get into the curling toes, like, I don't think that's a good thing. I think that can actually be detrimental because, okay, if you're training the toes, if you're on the heel and you're on the big toe, like look at the arch. It's not a strong arch. It's way, like that thing is super, it's very difficult to exercise, sure, but you're not training the arches. Like the arches first method, fifth, and then going all the way back to the heel, like making the triangle. But if you would just extend that crazy, I don't think that's good. It's going to be a difficult exercise, yes, but I don't think it's going to transfer to sports because that is a weak arch when you're going off like the big toe all the way to the heel.
Yeah, you just need enough for that active foot position, essentially. Activate that kind of transverse arch, and then you can kind of go from there, so to speak.
Yeah, and I just have people put me in videos sometimes and they're like crazy on the toes, and I'm like, that's fine. You're probably not doing any harm. It's a freaking ISO lunge, but I'm like, maybe you make it better. Maybe you get more back on the arches.
Yeah,
it's definitely, or on the arch. I guess not all the arches, just the front arch.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not comfortable when you go that high as well, because I've played around with different positions, and yeah, it sucks. Just moving on.
Sometimes it'll be like people. So people talk about the knees over toes guy. He does like crazy knee forward stuff. And they're like, "Would you ever thought of doing an iso lunge with that?" And I'm like, "I have, but it's just kind of uncomfortable." And I don't really hit that. I don't really hit that position in sport. That's why that crazy shin angle drop, you'll see it in an acceleration if you're a good accelerator. Yeah. But if you're like landing or you're jumping, like it's more like the shin angle is going to be more straight up, you know, because that's what's propelling you upwards is the shin angle is straight up and down. And that's meant for vertical propulsion. If you're trying to go that way, if the shin angle is more parallel with the ground, that's what you'll see. And when you're sprinting too, it's not like a high patellar load. It's not the same as jumping or landing. So it's like, I mean, I played around with it, but I'm like, if you just keep the knee up and like at the shin vertical, I think you're good. If you want to play around with that, that's cool. But you could also be it could also be uncomfortable if you have a patellar tendon issue, because you're in the crazy deep knee flexion. So maybe that's something you avoid.
Yeah, for sure. Just moving on there slightly. So like we've talked a little bit there about jumping. And I know you actually posted about this recently as well. How much jumping should we do? Because there's different schools of thought on this. Like some people like to jump a lot. Some people think we should periodize our jumps. Different types of jumps are going to cause different stress. Obviously, you've got more of a vertical jump compared to a broad jump. Like broad jumps can be more stressful as well. Like, how should we approach that?
It probably individual with everyone. And the thing that's interesting with that is like Jill Cook, tendon researcher, talked about when. So like how jumper's knee is so much more common in males than females. And what's the reason for that? There's so many schools of thought. I'm trying to wrap my head around it. One of the schools of thought is like males often who can jump high, they have a really good patellofemoral joint, and females don't have a good patellofemoral joint. Look at the way their hips are set up. Their knees are coming in, pretty much all females. So their patellofemoral joint pain is going to give out before they can actually get to a point where their patellar tendon starts hurting. So that's one line of thought is the structure of that. One line of thought too is boys reach puberty later in life and the patellar tendon doesn't like fully adapt until they reach that. It's called like peak height velocity, like 1 or 2 years afterwards that they have grown their most. That is when the patellar tendon is actually fully developed. So one argument is if you take boys who are 16 or 15, let's say 15, it's not fully adapted. 15 years old and you're killing them with basketball, you're killing them with jumps and lands, you could be causing pathology already before it's developed, versus a girl is already there at like 13, 14. The likelihood that she's just killing herself with jumping and landing is not likely, because coaches are, in my opinion, coaches are less likely to kill someone as they're younger, you know, like it's just not going to happen. As you get older, coaches don't care. It's all about mental toughness, whatever. So the boys could experience more patellar loading because of that, and boys could also experience it too, because there was one study they looked at, like I think it was 16 17 18 maybe year old volleyball players, and the males jumped way more in the same amount of time than the females did in like matches, practices, so the males were way more likely to jump more. So maybe it could be because guys just jump more often, because the jumping and landing is high patellar tendon load. So it could be those reasons. It could be the patellofemoral joint. It could be so many things. It could be another reason. It could be because guys see other guys on Instagram doing crazy dunks and they want to get on the court and dunk, but maybe girls don't care so much about dunking. Maybe girls don't ever see that much progress in their vertical jump. So they just don't train it that often. And they don't really care about it. I don't know the mechanism. It could be the patellofemoral pain holds them back from doing a lot of practice. Sorry, what was the question again?
Well, just like the different types of jumps and the
oh yeah, yeah. Okay,
the stresses yep. involved.
Yeah. So I wanted to build up into it, because it's like when we talk about giving you a limitation on how many jumps to do or something like that, is like, mm-hmm. well, if we look at why does it happen in the first place, you know? And looking at the male female thing, it can hopefully get the gears turning in your head. But like jump science, I've talked with all these guys like personally, which has been cool, because they're really smart guys. He says about like 50 jumps per week, but he also says if you're before puberty, you can get away with more jumps. So it's like that would kind of go against the argument of when you're before puberty, you shouldn't do a ton of jumping. But he's saying you could get away with it. So it's like maybe they can get away with it because they don't jump as high, and it's not as high patellar load because kids are jumping like 10 inches high, you know, who knows. But then he says, after you reach that, you probably need maybe 50. And if you have a long history of jumping, you don't even need to do that to enhance it. So 50 like max effort jumps. If you look at Jordan Kilgannon's story, he used to say he would jump for like hours every single day. And then he actually back and forth, he says now he only jumps two sessions a week for the last 8 years or so. But back in the day, he would jump 9 hours. He'd jump every single day. So it's like, and he said he never had knee pain. He didn't have knee pain until like a few years after that. He started to try to go single leg or something like that, try to do single leg jumping out of nowhere, and he got crazy knee pain. But now he does two. Basketball, I was listening to a podcast. He does two sessions. I think Knees Over Toes guy talks about doing two sessions. So it's like, if you want to, and with Basketball, he was like, one session is kind of just messing around, and one session is like serious jumping. So it's like, you see on Instagram these guys dunk videos, and you just get the idea that they're dunking every day. You know, and it's like they're probably not. And I think if we can learn from these people who are very good at it, if they're only doing two sessions a week of like strict jumping, maybe that's the best thing to do. For me, I mean, I've dunked every single day, but it's like, is that a way to enhance your performance at it? For me, probably not. Probably just staying stagnant because it's like, it's like the CNS fatigue argument where it's like you have it's a very high stimulus. You need 48, 72 hours. That would kind of go along with it. But if you're trying to save your patellar tendons, like what can we do to make them more resilient? Lifting. Like basically that's what Jill Cook, those reasons say is like to add mechanical strength to the tendon, you need 70% load or heavier, and you need to go like, maybe it's an isometric, maybe it's up and down contractions. You need heavy load to add mechanical stiffness. She's even said plyometrics don't add mechanical stiffness. And I'm like, what? Like, that doesn't make any sense. How do we get mechanically stiff? How does anyone get mechanically stiff tendons then if they're jumpers? Cause a lot of guys don't lift who are jumpers. Mm-hmm. And they probably got some pretty strong tendons. That's another thing too, where the researchers are kind of different, because Keith Barr says, if you want stiffness of your tendon, just do fast movements. If you want stiffness of your patellar tendon, jump and land. That's it. If you want them to be less stiff and healthier, do the slow isometric or the slow loading. So those are kind of differences within the researchers, but I would always look
somewhere
at how can we,
do you think it's,
I don't know. Like,
yeah,
I don't, I'm like, how can we, like, okay, so if we say 50 jumps, if we say two sessions a week, how do we push the envelope? You know, how do we make the patellar tendon more resilient? Mm-hmm. And I don't have the answer to it. but you could definitely overdo it. And that's the thing. Once you overdo the patellar tendon, once you overdo any tendon and it gets pathological, there's good evidence that it's going to stay that way forever. So the best thing you can do is just not overdo it. And a lot of sport coaches should probably hear that because they just care about killing people. And luckily sport coaches kill people with running and not jumping. I wonder how many patellar tendinopathies we'd have, or I mean, with females, maybe ACL tears, if we just overdid jumping, like max effort jumping over and over, but often it'll just be through running. And we didn't talk much about the Achilles tendon, but like the Achilles tendon, because it's not as simple as the patellar tendon, you can have so many other issues because there's so much more going on with the Achilles tendon. Like there's other muscles and bones around the area. Patellar tendon is pretty much just that. There's like a fat pad that can cause some compression or issues. But the patellar tendon, there's like a peritendon, whatever the phrase is, that is like outside of it that can cause issues if you're like a cyclist or a swimmer because of the repetitive motion. You don't get the same thing with the patellar tendon. So the Achilles can have other issues that are, it's a little bit more confusing, and that's something that I have been like, I don't want to get into the Achilles because then you'd have to talk about running mechanics. And if you're someone who's like a pusher, they tell you to push, you're probably like class one lever, class two lever, you're probably more class one lever more of the time, which is probably worse on your Achilles tendon. If you could be more class two, class one meaning the foot's like way more out in front of you. Once the foot is underneath you or behind you, it's going class two. Class one levers, and the stronger you are and the heavier you are, you're probably gonna be more class one. So for me, when I do an acceleration, I can go class one because I'm strong and that's actually good for me, but it might not be the best for my Achilles tendon. And I've talked to people over quarantine who are basically like big, strong dudes who get into sprinting and their Achilles tendon starts flaring up. And I just wonder how much of that is because, well, obviously maybe they're not load tolerant. If they haven't built it up slowly, that's probably the main thing. But I wonder too, if they're staying more class one, or instead of class two, and they're just like reaching out in front and really pushing, and you, and maybe you film it, and you can see the Achilles actually, you can see the Achilles not really storing and releasing, but actually like lengthening a little bit. Like maybe that's caused issues there. But yeah, the Achilles is a whole different thing to tackle. Patellar tendon is a lot more simple, even though it's not simple.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, as soon as you start getting into more things to do with the Achilles and running mechanics, then you open a whole new can of worms.
Yeah.
Just, I know time's obviously getting on just a little bit here, and I know you've got things to do. I just want to get into, before we finish here, hypertrophy clusters. That's something that I'm running myself. So thanks for sending me that. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
How about we just get into it, maybe just discuss a little bit kind of why you think it works so well. I'm enjoying it at the moment. It's going great. But why does it work so well? Why is it a different approach to traditional hypertrophy? And why is it maybe better for an athlete?
Yeah. So, I mean, I got into that because of Jonathan Oliver was he's like a cluster set researcher, but he did a study with like trained Marines, pretty legit study. It was like 12 weeks long, and it was basically 4 sets of 10 versus 8 sets of 5. So same exact load. You just, double the sets, cut the reps in half. And at the end of it, similar lean mass gains, better strength gains in clusters, better power gains in clusters. So basically the repetition quality was better. You can even shorten the rest, but it's like, if you just cut your sets instead of going higher, the repetitions quality is better. The speed is better. And if you're an athlete, like basketball, football, anyone who's interested in speed, I think if you're taking like my hypertrophy phase is 8 weeks, some people have done shorter, 6 weeks. But if you're taking 8 weeks and you're just doing like grinding sets and it's just slow and it's actually causing muscle compensations because you're squatting and now your glutes tire out or something, and now you're doing your low back erectors and you just see the quality going down, like that's probably not the best for a team sport athlete. If you're interested in explosiveness, anything about explosiveness, sprinting, jumping is all about quality, high quality reps. So in the weight room, is like, that's the difficulty with hypertrophy, because hypertrophy is not really about quality. It's about like getting to that failure point, destroying yourself. So mixing it up like hypertrophy clusters, I think is a way. Now, obviously you just did the first week and you're feeling beat up because that's just what's going to happen. You just go from like
straight out of quarantine into it, you know,
like you just, and you could have an adjustment period, but I just said, screw it. People don't need an adjustment period. The reason why people can't gain muscle, can't get strong, is because they're not doing enough volume at a given intensity. Maybe they do a lot of volume, but the sets aren't actually that hard. Or maybe they do a lot of intensity, but they're not getting enough volume. So it's like, if you can have a program, it's all laid out. Here's the amount of reps you need to do at the certain percentage, and you actually do it. That's how people are going to make gains. And then you just got to eat enough food to actually gain weight. And my guidelines, just if you just gain 1 to 2% every week, pretty simple. Like if you're not doing that and trying to gain weight, it's your fault. but hypertrophy clusters is kind of a way I wanted to figure out, because everything I write about is how do we build muscle, build strength, and also keep the athletic performance there. And I had never found good resources on that. So it's like, I made the hypertrophy clusters for someone to train at a high quality in the weight room, in the compound exercises. When you get to the isolation stuff, you can just kill yourself because it doesn't actually affect you that bad. And then you can keep your athletic performance, but you also make muscle gain, strength gain, and a lot of fun, man. And I think too, if we talk about energy systems, like when we're trying to enhance an energy system of a football player, basketball player, is like, it's a short sprint and then a jog or a rest, short sprint, jog and a rest. And you're doing hypertrophy. It's like your set might last 30 seconds, maybe 60 seconds. And then you rest 3 to 5 minutes or something. Mm-hmm. Energy system is also, if you're trying to develop work capacity, just general work capacity, or I guess a little bit more specific work capacity because of the work to rest intervals, it's a little bit more closely matched when you do 8 sets of 5, because your sets are maybe 10, 15 seconds. And then you're resting about 1 minute, 90 seconds, 2 minutes, something like that. So it's a little bit more close to that. And again, if you're going to spend 8 weeks on hypertrophy and you're not going to be at least somewhat specific, I think you're spending a lot of time to do something that could not be the best for you in the long run. I definitely think like hitting the lactate stuff is important, like whole body, but doing it with your squats and your deadlifts and your bench, I just don't think in the long run that's the best thing to do.
Yeah, so, I think there's limited carryover to a degree there as well. It's like you said, 3 by 10, like, is that really the best way to go? And I think the neat thing with that program is, you, without giving away the secret to the program, so go out and buy it, guys, but I think that the sprints and the jumps and stuff that you put in there are great as well, because it kind of touches on that constant beat of athleticism, you know?
Yeah. And like, if you can get out and do athletic things, that'd be the best thing. Like a lot of my videos, I'm playing spike ball before I train. So it's like, there are things you get in spike ball with vision, with the brain, with, if you're playing with someone, communication. Yeah. Yes. This is very general. Does it transfer to basketball? I have no, probably not, but it touches on that like athleticism, which when we say athleticism, there's really no marker for athleticism because it's specific, but yeah, it touches on that quality instead of like just a basic dynamic warm-up. So it's like, but at the same time, you could have cases, because if you were working with a basketball team, they basically play basketball all year round. Do they need to do more athletic stuff, or could it just be draining their energy, fatiguing them, and then they can't go and get the amount of volume they need in the weight room to get hypertrophy? So it's like, it's case by case basis, but yeah, definitely keeping in a little bit of everything at once, but it's always about, it's about volume, and you need to put the majority of your work you're doing to the volume that's going to actually provide hypertrophy. And that's how you need to run a hypertrophy phase.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the quality of the sets is actually, it's much higher as well. And then one of the main things that you've got to do there is obviously drive the intent on each rep, so you're getting that type 2 fiber hypertrophy as well.
Yeah, it's the best in the world, huh?
That's what you got to get. Look, Jake, I know time's getting on here, so I'll let you go. I know you got a meeting to get to, but really appreciate you taking time out of your day to talk shop here. So thanks very much.
Yeah, for sure. No problem, man.
Thanks.